Fugette Clark lived a reclusive life and was seldom seen or heard from after she suddenly withdrew from the public eye around the 1930s. It was only discovered later that when she was 82, she'd moved into a simple New York City hospital room despite being in excellent health. In his new book, Empty Mansions, The Mysterious Life of Fugette Clark and the Spending of a Great American Fortune, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and NBC News investigative reporter Bill Deadman writes about how he uncovered the mystery of Fugette Clark and the battle over her $300 million inheritance that ensued after her death in 2011. It's published by Ballantyne Books, and I'm very pleased it has brought Bill Deadman to our show today. Hello.
Hi, Leonard. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Wasn't a tentative deal over the will, or should we say wills, reached just this weekend?
Yes. The family's in court, her distant relatives, seeking a big share of her $300 million fortune. They seem to have worked out a deal. We're expecting that to be in court this afternoon or tomorrow morning.
And what was the problem, that there were two wills and they had been written fairly close to each other?
That was true, but wasn't the main problem. The family contends that this reclusive woman, whom they last saw in the 1950s, and most of them had never met her, they contended that she was mentally ill, that she must have been. She lived alone. She played with dolls. So they've contended that she had no idea where her fortune was going. She had written them out of the will.
Well, she had written them out of the will and given money to charities. It seems to me that's not a sign of losing a sense of reality.
It does.
But perhaps it says, well, you know, I don't know these relatives. They've never come to visit me. The charities are really important to support.
Well, if you leave no money to your family in your will and you haven't set up the charity before you die, the lesson here may be that the family may come and contest it. She had it might be a surprise if in the will what we had were beneficiaries who were a surprise to her. But we have a loving goddaughter who'd written her letters, her doctor, her hospital, and the charities at her beloved home in Santa Barbara. So where she had not been since the 1950s, but she wanted it to be preserved as she remembered it.
Do we know if something happened to cause her to leave less money to her family?
Her best friend, Madame Pierre, Suzanne Pierre, who visited her in the hospital and brought her she hated the hospital food, by the way. Huguette was living in the hospital for 7,000 nights, but she didn't like the hospital food.
She's paying $7,000 a night?
She was paying $400,000 a year. She was in the hospital for 7,000 nights.
That's practical. They can name a building after you.
Yes.
For that.
Well, she gave the hospital a Manet painting worth $3.5 million. Well, so her best friend said that she was afraid that her family was going to try to get her money, and it turned out that that was the case.
Had you heard about Fugette Clark before you started your investigation that would later become a series of reports for NBC News?
No. My family and I in Connecticut were shopping for a house, and we got a little bit out of our price range. I was looking at the top of the listings, and I noticed that this house was for sale for $24 million in New Canaan, Connecticut.
Le Beau Chateau.
Yes, the beautiful castle. And looking up the owner, Fugette Clark, online, I didn't recognize the name, and I saw in the town records that her attorney had told the town this house has not been occupied since this owner bought it in 1951. But that wasn't her nicest house. The Santa Barbara, California house, maybe $100 million worth, she hadn't been there. And on Fifth Avenue, New York City, she had the view that everyone wants, overlooking Central Park at 72nd Street.
Right near the Frick Museum.
Yes, just up from the Frick, and overlooking the Conservatory Pond. And she had 15,000 square feet there in three apartments, with paintings by Renoir and Monet, but she had not been there. She had not seen those apartments in the last 20 years of her life.
You decided, even though you couldn't afford the yes. place in New Canaan, to drive up there the next day?
Yes, I went to see the caretaker, and I knocked, rapped on the window, and he came out, and he said he just was paid by the attorney every month, and he'd been there 20 years, had never seen the owner, and he asked me, do you think that maybe she's been dead all these years? So at that point, I was hooked. We had to find out what was going on with these mansions.
And you described the mansion you saw as more like a nature preserve than a home.
Yes. Turkeys, deer, geese. The caretaker and his son, the animal lover, lived there. But she had bought this home in 1951 and had never moved a stick of furniture into it. It seemed to have been a refuge, purchased during the Cold War as a safe place for her and her staff to go if New York was attacked.
Did she ever work a day in her life?
No, except that she was an artist. She was at least a serious amateur artist. She was well-trained. We have pictures of her paintings in the book. A lovely view out of her window onto Fifth Avenue. In the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, she was a serious artist and a collector of fine art as well.
And her father had been a collector.
Yes. Her father had built the house that was her childhood home. At 77th and 5th Avenue, 121 rooms, 30 bathrooms. You could have a different one every day of the month if you chose. It had five art galleries, was open to the public on Saturdays for viewing. And that art collection, after the father died in 1925, that art went to the Corcoran Gallery in Washington, D.C.
Now, what was he doing on 5th Avenue? He was a copper industrialist. He had been a senator from Montana twice. He was a railroad baron and a founder of Las Vegas.
Yes. He was born in a log cabin. That's good for a political career in Pennsylvania. He'd gone west and gotten rich in the mines and in merchandising and banking in Montana. He made money in the mines in Arizona. He built the railroad that connected Los Angeles to the east through Salt Lake City, and he needed a little watering stop along the way of his railroad, and he sold lots near that stop, and it became Las Vegas.
Wasn't he involved in a scandal that led to the adoption of the 17th Amendment?
Yes. He was accused of having bought his way into the Senate in Montana, bribing the legislators. He seemed to pay more than his competitor. The famous quotation attributed to W.A. Clark is, "I never bought a man who wasn't for sale." There's an entertaining episode where he resigns from the U.S. Senate ahead of being thrown out. And they time the resignation so that they get the governor of Montana out of the state. They trick him to leave the state so that his lieutenant governor will appoint a successor. Guess who was appointed to fulfill the vacancy made when W.A. Clark resigned? W.A. Clark. It's one of the great political shenanigans of all time.
So that inspired people to propose the 17th Amendment.
Yes, he was ridiculed on magazine covers, and Montana was ridiculed. And the idea of giving the popular vote was not a new idea, but of letting the people elect senators was an idea given wind by the Clark scandal.
And then they reelected him to Senate.
Yes, the people of Montana sent him back. And, of course, we still today have deep pockets having a great deal of influence on election of senators.
I'm speaking with Bill Dedman, who, with the help of Paul Clark Newell Jr., has written a book called Empty Mansions, The Mysterious Life of Huguette Clark and the Spending of a Great American Fortune, published by Ballantyne Books. Now, what was Paul Clark Newell's role in all of this?
So Paul is Huguette's cousin. He's not involved in the legal battle. He's not one of the relatives seeking her fortune. He was doing a family history, and he was a little bit better investigative reporter than I was. He'd found Huguette's telephone number in California, and he would place calls through her attorney. She would call him back. They spoke for 9 years. And in the audiobook, you can hear parts of their conversation. She recalled very vividly how they had tickets on the Titanic's return trip. And she said, well, we had to go on a different boat. She recalled the Santa Barbara earthquake in 1925. She had a great memory. She was quite chatty in person, but very private and reclusive, wouldn't allow visitors.
Where had she grown up?
She was born in Paris in 1906 during the Roosevelt administration. Here she was living to the Obama administration, living to 104. And she grew up in this house on Fifth Avenue in New York. She attended the Spence School on the Upper East Side, and that was the end of her education. And then she became a painter, a lover of music, and lived very quietly at home.
How much of his estate did he leave to Huguette when he died?
She got one-fifth. He had children from the first marriage. That's the ancestors of those who are in court now. And four children from that marriage, the four surviving, got four-fifths of his fortune. He was probably one of the 50 richest Americans of all time. He's probably the richest a most famous American no one today has heard of. She got one-fifth of that fortune.
And did she live lavishly with all that money?
It's funny. You could say that she lived extravagantly. She spent $400,000 to make copies of her own furniture to make a bedroom. She bought dolls at $15,000 a throw twice in a day. But she was also relentlessly generous, giving her nurse more than $30 million. We can talk about that. And the woman who brought her warm milk in the mornings at Beth Israel Hospital, she wrote a check for $25,000 to her.
She was briefly married from 1928 to 1930, but that was around the time she kind of left the public sphere.
Yes, it doesn't seem to be caused by the marriage, though there was a lot of publicity, the $30 million heiress and the $50 a week clerk getting divorced. It doesn't seem as though there's any one easy explanation for why she became reclusive. Her mother was quite private, and the two of them lived in the same building on Fifth Avenue, separate apartments. It seems that the reclusivity she got from her mother.
There were attempts to set her up with other men.
Yes. I spoke with an elderly man. He was in a nursing home in Alabama. He since died. But he described for me how he had 16 first dates with Huguette Clark. 16 times he was set up. And every time she couldn't get her hair right or her dress wasn't quite right. But here she was, nearly 100 and in the news for her millions, and he said, would you let her know if she ever gets her hair done, I'm available.
The photo that's often used in articles about her was taken in 1930. Were there more recent ones?
Yes. In the book, we have photos. She would pose for Polaroids at Christmas or Easter in her apartment, and she was quite she looked quite happy in the photos that she took.
Well, you write that she described her home at 907 Fifth Avenue as spooky. Was that the reason that she moved to Mount Sinai Hospital?
Yeah, she got into her 80s, and here she was in 42 rooms with expensive paintings by herself. There was an intruder who got in, locked a maid in a closet. It was a little scary for her, and she ended up with an illness. She ended up with cancers of the face that were not treated. She'd outlived her doctor. She'd outlived her staff. She didn't do well with new people, so she hadn't hired new people. And here she was with these very serious facial cancers. She called a friend who sent a doctor, and they got her into the hospital. And once she got in the hospital, she said, I feel more comfortable here. I'm safer. And she had no luxuries in the hospital room. She didn't seem to need the paintings and the gilded age trinkets that she'd lived with.
And the cancer went away?
It did. It was cured.
Because she lived for many years after.
Yeah, she lived for 20 years. It was cured, and she wasn't seriously disfigured.
So why didn't she move into an assisted living facility or a senior citizen community?
She said no nursing home. She'd gotten a bad, as I suppose many older people do, she'd gotten a bad association with nursing homes. And the hospital allowed her to stay, of course, because she was paying this $400,000 a year.
They don't have any reservations about keeping somebody who's not ill in a hospital room?
It's a serious ethical question of whether or not they didn't have a discharge plan for her. When the inspectors came, employees told me that they hid her because they didn't want the accreditation inspectors to stumble across the file of this patient who'd been there for 20 years. And they knew that they had someone who, as the head of the hospital said, could give us the super mega gift, the $125 million gift.
I wonder what would have happened if she had lived into Obamacare.
That might have changed the rules. But she wasn't a Medicare patient. She was paying her own way.
And she died just a couple of years ago.
She died after she became famous again in her old age, at 2 weeks before her 105th birthday.
Was she still living in Mount Sinai?
It was Beth Israel. She had moved from Beth Israel, from the old doctor's hospital on the Upper East Side. She'd moved down to Beth Israel at 17th Street and 1st Avenue.
And was she just died of natural causes?
Yes, pneumonia, old age, pneumonia. Her heart finally gave out at 104.
She didn't have a funeral service or a mass.
No, her attorney said that she didn't want any such thing. So some of her relatives who were in the game at that point were quite upset that they were not being told when she was buried. She's in the Clark Mausoleum in the Bronx at Woodlawn Cemetery.
Who worked out this tentative deal that is going to be resolved today?
So the New York State Attorney General's office, Mr. Schneiderman's office, has attempted to preserve the money for the charities, her California home going to the charities, and the family's getting a share of more than $30 million, plus the estate's paying their estate taxes and paying their attorney's fees, so that's net to them. And goddaughter's getting a share, but it was all worked out. They said if the trial that was scheduled, 6 to 8 weeks, had gone on, there were more than 60 attorneys involved in the case. You'd be churning up more than $100,000 of additional legal fees of every day of trial.
Well, I'm sure the hospital misses her. She was giving them nearly $500,000 a year.
Yes, but they might be dreadfully disappointed. Here they were seeking $125 million. You can see some of their schemes in a chapter of the book. And in the end, in the will, the hospital got only one of her more than $300 million, a disappointing result for them.
Bill Dedman, who won a Pulitzer Prize for a very different kind of reporting, has written a book called Empty Mansions with the help of Paul Clark Newell, Jr., The Mysterious Life of Huguette Clark and the Spending of a Great American Fortune. It is published by Ballantyne Books, and Mr. Dedman will be giving a reading and signing books tonight at 7 o'clock at the Half King at 505 West 23rd Street. Thank you so much for being on our show today.
Thank you, Leonard.